Dear listeners, hello and thank you for joining us for the 241st edition of Sudbury News Talk magazine. I'm Michelle Mandry and I hope you're well and enjoying the sunshine. Isn't it good to feel warm again? Before we begin, I do have some sad news concerning Paula Short. Sadly, Paula died at the end of April and we send our condolences to her family and friends. Paula was a familiar voice on the magazine and had volunteered her time and voice to tell really enjoyable stories of her life and travels. As one of her volunteers put it, Paula was always a vital and valuable member of the magazine team. Paula retired from the magazine early last year, a loss then for sure and sorely missed now. Today, though, the magazine is all about grandparents, mostly long lamented, but also in the here and now. The topic was suggested by Richard Fawcett, and as ever, we have a varied offering for you. First in the hot seat is Jackie McSweeney to tell us how she feels about the gift of grandparents.
Thank you, Michelle. Hello, everyone. I want to take a few moments to talk about some of the most special people in our lives, our grandparents. Grandparents are like timeless treasures. They are the roots of our family tree, the storytellers from our past, and often the quiet strength that holds everything together. Whether we call them grandma, grandpa, nana, papa, or by any other affectionate name, their role in our lives is truly irreplaceable. One of the most beautiful things about grandparents is the unconditional love they give. It's the love that is patient, forgiving, and filled with warmth. They spoil us, not just treat us with gifts, but with time, wisdom, and stories that stretch back generations. They have this incredible ability to make us feel special, valued, and safe, no matter how old we are. Grandparents are living history books. For them, we learn about life before the internet, before smartphones, even colour TV. Through their stories, we discover how our family came to be, its traditions, its struggles, its triumphs. Listening to them is a bit like opening a window into the past, and in doing so we gain a better understanding of ourselves. But grandparents are not just figures of the past, they are active participants in our present. They show up at school plays, help with homework, and cheer the loudest at sports day. Some of them even become our full-time caregivers, stepping in when life takes unexpected turns. They do so much, often without asking for anything in return. And if we're lucky, we get to watch them laugh and play with our children, passing down not only traditions and values, but also love that spans across generations. The bond between grandparents and grandchildren is truly something magical. Sadly, though, many of us only come to appreciate the full value of our grandparents when they're no longer with us. That's why it's so important to cherish the time we have with them. Ask them questions. Visit them. Listen to their stories, even if you've heard them before. Let them know how much they matter. Let us never forget that grandparents are a precious gift, not just because of what they've done in the past, but because of the love they give us today. May we always honour them, not just in words, but in our actions. I am sadly not able to experience the joy of a grandparent, all having died before I was born. Neither am I in a position to know the delight of being a grandparent. But I'd like to say to all the grandparents out there, thank you. Thank you for your patience, your guidance, and your endless love. Thank you for being our role models, our safe havens, and our heroes. Your wisdom continues to shape us long after the stories are told. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie. That all rings very true to me. Thank you. Sorry, Jackie nearly had me in tears then, so I've had to gather myself. But our next item is from John King, who has a direct approach to remembering his grandparents.
The subject is grandparents. Reflecting on my grandparents, I have attempted to invoke them in my mind, images in full colour, and my impressions of them. The success I have had in this task is variable, which is why I have decided to present this as I am meeting them again face to face, or in the case of my granddad, White, for the very first time. Of course, the conversations are somewhat one-sided. Like everyone, of course, I have four biological grandparents. My maternal grandfather, Herbert White. I never knew your granddad. And even my mother, no memory of you. She was only three when you were fatally wounded in the dying days of that cruel and pointless conflict known as World War I. It was, in fact, the start of a mechanised wholesale slaughter as you lay wounded on the battlefield. Apart from the pain, you must have been so lonely, away from your family, never to see your two young children again. You were taken to a German hospital, where despite their efforts, you died. We have a letter from the hospital informing of your death, and we know you are buried in Germany. We have a photograph of you, in uniform, on our stair wall. And of course, a portion of your genes are still going down the generations, so you are remembered. My maternal grandmother, Florence White, stroke Lane. You, I know, were a formidable woman. Born Florence Hempstead, you married Herbert White and were soon widowed in 1918. Your second relationship with one Jack Lane produced another five children. Jack was a force to be reckoned with a dubious businessman who made a lot of money, spent freely, and too predictably the money ran out. You ran a pine ale shop in London prior to getting out of the city when World War II bombing started. I came to see you regularly as a little boy. In your pantry, you always had demijohns of country wine bubbling out their fermenting gas. When supplies and money allowed, a three-pint jug of the ale was fetched from the White Horse, White Hart, just across the road. I had my first little sup of beer from that jug, and I never looked back. You never suffered fools gladly, and was wary of being foisted off at the butchers by a bit of what you called cagmag, as you called it. This alluded to a bit of fat or gristle worked into the meagre meat rations. I have to tell you, if you're listening, that I absolutely loathe your mutton stew. All that thin white gravy with bits of bone. I have since learned that many people hated this dish, not just yours. I love lamb, but not that stew. On a serious note, I'm so grateful for your saving my life when I was 1 year old. As you know, both my twin brother, Peter, and I were seriously ill with pleurisy pneumonia. There were no antibiotics, so he sat with us taking in turns with Mum for several nights, clearing us with our throats when we choked and giving us a kiss of life by breathing into us. Peter was smaller than I was, and he did not make it, but you managed to have saved me. 85 years later, typing this makes me feel a little wet-eyed. Now for something completely different. My paternal grandparents were in fact nothing like the material side, but very good to us. This gave me a really good variety of influences from my formative years. My paternal granddad, Charles David King. I was always deferent to you, Grandad, because your demeanour demanded it. As my dad was the youngest of your children, you were the oldest of my grandparents. I suppose that as you had a moustache and walking stick, I couldn't actually age you at all. But I imagine that my first memories of you were when you were about 70. You started a business as a grocer and a seedsman, and you managed a large nursery and four reasonable sized fields. Look at you on your winter's day, sitting by the fire in your armchair. It was kind of hard for me to believe that you had been a champion runner. We still have pictures and some of your trophies. I love coming to the nursery with you, and you really love being there. So much so, when the lorry broke down, you demanded you were pushed up there in a wheelbarrow by two of your sons. It was over a mile. As far as they can make out, you took life as it came, and you paid your bills when your crops came in. You were a tough country person, and so you take all necessary actions to remove unwanted animals. You raised pigs for sharing during the war. Eels were hung up on hooks for skinning. Guns were kept in the corner of the living room, always broken. The cartridges were in a sideboard. There were two 12 bores and a 410. I never touched one of them because I was told firmly not to, and that was that. I don't think there were many like you around. My paternal grandma, Polly Ann King. Polly, I would never have addressed you as such. No, you are only ever Granny. I was told that you left school at the age of 12, although your beautiful cursive writing belied that. As with all non-moneyed women of your time, life was hard. You had seven children, two girls and five boys. Three of them were sadly predeceased you. There were virtually no kitchen or household aides, although I believe you used the services of a washerwoman, Ada, I remember. Apart from all this domesticity, I remember you writing on every packet of C.D. King seeds prior to weighing and packing them. With no refrigeration, you used a food safe in the cool cellar and preserved food by bottling and salting whilst keeping eggs in ice and glass. Your death when I was just 15 was very painful and depressive for me. However, along with my other grandparents, you have left me with many indelible and incredible memories. Thank you all.
Thank you, John. Some sweet and sad conversations there. Thank you for sharing them with us. Margaret Hibble can't be with us today, so I will read for her. And she's taken a different approach. The best things about being a grandparent. I have been a grandmother for 27 years, and these have been some of the happiest years of my life. It is often said that grandparents enjoy all the best bits of looking after children, then hand them back to their parents. Up to a point, that is true. But being a grandparent also brings responsibilities. I have four grandchildren, all with completely different personalities, but all loved unconditionally. I have been able to share in all their lives at different times and in different ways. I have loved watching them grow up and develop into the young adults they are now. We created memories along the way and shared many family memories too. My oldest grandson, at 27, is interested to hear stories of the social history of our family. How things were when we were children and then growing up. How things have changed in the last 27 years, both socially and technologically. My 21-year-old granddaughter, at present taking her final exams at Cambridge University, is more interested in our family history. The dates and facts and figures. Our 15-year-old, the youngest and an aspiring ballet dancer, just rolls her eyes and with a smile on her face says, "Is this another one of your stories, Grandma?" We always loved playing with the grandchildren. Everything from Lego, Playmobil, Barbie dolls, board games, and of course, ball games in the garden. As retired grandparents, time to play doesn't have to be restricted. I've always loved baking, so making cakes together was always fun, especially when there was a sweet treat to be enjoyed later. Even cleaning up the mess didn't seem too much of a chore. Being grandparents can be challenging and tiring at times, but above all, my experience of being a grandparent has been a joy filled with fun, laughter, and love. Thank you, Margaret Hibble. You make grandparenting sound like great fun. I'm very pleased now to introduce our guest this evening, Colin Wright, who is here to tell us about the Cornard Environment and Wildlife Group. If you don't know it, Great Cornard is a village adjoining Sudbury downriver on the banks of the Stour. And I'll hand you over to Colin.
Thank you. The Cornard Environment and Wildlife Group was established in 2023 by Sharon Bowman and myself, following our attendance at a workshop and presentation for parish councillors hosted by Wilder Together in the Stour Valley programme, and the event highlighted the importance of local wildlife groups and provided guidance on how to set them up. With the support of the Great Cornard Parish Council, we founded the group after a minimal of discussion. I should say that we didn't really have to, Sharon and I were on the same wavelength because we are, in fact, father and daughter. But we both have an interest in the wildlife and in the local wildlife especially. But we were really founded because there were certain conflicts of interest in some areas of the village. There's those spaces which are shared by the public for recreational use, while also being vital to the preservation and enhancement of local wildlife in the Cornard region. The group's creation stemmed from the need to balance the protection of wildlife habitats with their use for leisure activities. It was the opinion of the council that an independent group would be more effective in achieving these aims than the parish council itself. Two inaugural public meetings were held, and as a result, the Cornard Environment and Wildlife Group was formed. Various grants were successfully applied for, and this has enabled us to start acquiring equipment and materials for various projects. We are grateful to the Cooperative Group Limited, who are our largest source of funding. Progress was slow at first, but in 2005, some fruits of the seeds sown in 2023 and 2024 have become apparent, and we have been pleased with our achievements, although other projects remain frustratingly difficult to bring to fruition. Sarah Davis, our Vice Chair, has led initiatives with pupils of Potkiln School in Great Cornard and local residents to create areas of wildflowers around the residential neighbourhood of the school. Having prepared some of the land last year, yellow rattle is now blooming. Yellow rattle is an important plant in the establishment of wildflower meadow. Sarah has also been active in the installation of swift boxes in both Great and Little Cornard. She has been ably assisted in this by Lee Norton, who has done all the installations for us. Save Our Swifts is a county-wide initiative to encourage the provision of swift boxes in many locations in Suffolk, and we have also provided resources to the project. Thomas Gainsborough School preferred to do their own installation on their building, which will provide an ideal location for swift boxes. As yet, we have had no feedback as to progress. Sarah has also worked with our local church, St Andrew's in Cornard, to install swift boxes in the church tower. On the subject of a provision of bird nesting sites, Debbie King, our ornithologist, has been proactive in encouraging Beaver District Council to enforce planning requirements and provide some hands-on assistance to them. Now at least some nest boxes should be provided, but it would have been easier if the correct planning requirements had been followed during the building. We have replaced some hedging in Blackhouse Lane and would like to expand the work in the future once we can establish with certainty the correct ownership of some of the parcels of land. The role of tree warden, formerly held by members of the parish council, has now been designated to the CEWG. This will ensure that we all arboreal maintenance in the future will be viewed from the aspect of wildlife preservation as well as public safety. Litter picking is not one of the most glamorous of pastimes, but does provide an opportunity for people who are of like mind to meet informally and discuss local environment issues. We have restarted our 2025 litter picking program, so you can now expect to be raining on the fourth Sunday of every month between 10 and 12 a.m. We have taken over the maintenance of Great Cornard Library Garden. Hayley Stevens is leading this work. The work there has shown some tangible benefits thus far, and it is hoped that the garden will provide an attractive, peaceful retreat. Toad patrolling on Joe's Road, Cornard, Tye, was probably our most disappointing project this year, but it was certainly oversubscribed by enthusiastic people who on many evenings were willing to help, as there was and we were in the situation where we had more people willing to help than toads actually needing the help. In total, 84 toads were helped across the road, but sadly we counted at least 12 casualties. Two information evenings have been held at the Stevenson Centre, both reasonably well attended, but we are considering changing the timing of these events to attract a younger audience. What I have described here is a summary of the work of what that we have done so far and does not include the minor remedial work we have undertaken in the village. If it is considered to be interesting enough, we would be willing to give more detailed accounts of the projects I have described and, where appropriate, any follow-up information in future editions of your magazine.
Thank you very much, Colin, for coming to speak to our listeners this evening. It's really good to hear positive news about things happening locally with nature. But I think also it's really important and interesting to hear the nitty-gritty bits that go on behind the positive news stories. So thank you very much for coming, and we'll definitely take you up on your offer to come back again, or one of your colleagues. Thank you. And now, as a special treat, our sound engineer Trevor Green has something to tell us, following on from Colin's really interesting talk. Here's Trevor.
So yes, following on from Colin's talk about nature in the immediate area, this story goes back quite a long while, actually. I attended a dinner at Felixstowe and was present in front of the then Suffolk Chief of Police, who then stood up at the after dinner and gave his speech, and started off by saying, here's a story about a little town on the border of Suffolk called Sudbury, which of course then led my ears to prick up. What's he going to say? And the thing with it was, this was just after the time of when Idi Amin in Africa was deposed. And it turned out that his security advisor moved back to Britain, and he lived just this side of Bewers. And the story this police chief gave was the fact that this security advisor had gone to the Sudbury police station and asked for a shotgun license, to which the constable behind the desk desk, do you remember them? The constable behind the desk actually declined him. So the security chap went back to his place in Bewers and wrote a letter to the Sudbury police chief, whatever, inspector, and said that He'd been refused a shotgun license. However, he needed a shotgun license, and this is the animal connection. It was to keep the elephant population down in the Stour Valley. He was granted a license on the grounds that as there were no elephants in the Stour Valley, he was obviously doing a good job. And so there's the animal story with a local twist.
Well, wasn't that a treat? No elephants in the Stour Valley. Although the Stour lighters, which worked in pairs all along the navigation from Sudbury down to Manningtree, they used to be... They weren't actually on the lighters, but they used to be able to take the equivalent weight of 4 adult African elephants, which is something like 26 tons, which I think is
amazing.
Another link. Well, that's what we tell our school children when they visit, because it makes it relatable. Anyway, back to this evening's magazine. And the moment you've all been waiting for, the quiz. Question number one. In cricket, what name is given to a lower order batsman sent in to protect a key player late in the day? Number two. How many sides does a 50 pence have without looking? Three. What is the name of the tiger who seeks to kill Mowgli in the Jungle Book? 4. Who said when entering US customs, "I have nothing to declare but my genius"? 5. Who was Bing Crosby's partner in the Road to Morocco and other road films? 6. Which author invented the first name Wendy? 7. What is Scotland's national flower? 8. How many locks are there on the Suez Canal? 9. What is the name of the ancient Celtic fire festival traditionally celebrated at the beginning of May? And 10. What should you ne'er cast until May is out? And I'll be back with the answers later.
Sorry.
Before that, though, Ken Watkins is here with his take on the topic of grandparents.
I knew just one of my grandparents, my mum's father, William James Clark. But I didn't get to know his Christian names until I was about 10. He was always Grandad Clark, a man who wore a waistcoat, displayed a fob watch, and was all smartly turned out, whatever the weather. And he was the family's dog trainer. When my parents or any of my aunts and uncles got a new dog, then Grandad Clark would take charge of the training. I never knew a dog that didn't adore him, judging from the barks of delight whenever he appeared. He loved them, and they loved him, and it was always something I tried to emulate when I became a dog owner, long after Grandad Clark had gone. My parents had me late in life. Mum was 36 and Dad 40, which in the 1940s was considered extremely late to be having a first and only child. Much more commonplace now, but pretty rare at the end of the Second World War. My mum, Alice, had lost her mother, Elizabeth, when she was 20, and my dad, George, lost both his parents, Charles and Anne, in 1942, all three long gone before I was born. And Grandad Clark died when I was 12, so I never had a really long-term relationship with a grandparent. I always told our two children how lucky they were to have all four grandparents alive for more than just a few years. My parents both died in the mid-80s when our son was 12 and our daughter 9, but my wife Judy's parents were around for a few more years, father-in-law Harold dying in the mid-90s and mother-in-law Freddie in 2002. By which time our daughter had left home. My daughter Sue has very fond memories of my mum, always called Grandma, and Judy's mum, always called Nana, at her request. And my mum absolutely adored her grandchildren. We have a photograph of her sitting on the sofa, holding our son, after Judy brought him home from hospital. The smile on mum's face saying it all. She had a lovely, loving relationship with our two, sadly all too short-lived. We have no grandchildren, so I can never claim to be an expert on grandparenting. Our son Chris was disabled, and we lost him 18 years ago. Our daughter Sue and son-in-law Nathan decided they didn't want children, but then many of their friends and contemporaries have made the same decision, which is far from unusual now. Most of our friends and contemporaries had children in the 1970s, and the occasional couple who decided against it were often regarded, rather unfairly, as selfish. But perhaps they knew something we only discovered when our children arrived. Most of the people I grew up with, cousins or friends at school and later university, who were married around the same time as us, are in a similar position. They either have no grandchildren, or they have grandchildren who are some distance away. One friend has a grandchild in Australia, another a grandchild in New Zealand. Keeping in touch these days is so much easier with FaceTime, as we found when our daughter worked in the Virgin Islands. The internet connection was a boon, but it can never be the same as being in the same room, same town, or same country. But I was glad when she came back to Britain and was only half an hour away when we all lived in Suffolk, as also did my son-in-law's parents. It couldn't last, of course. Sue and Nathan moved to Keswick, we moved to South Wales, and Nathan's family moved to Portugal. So physical contact is a little limited. I have occasionally thought how life might have been different if our daughter had decided to have children and we had all stayed in Suffolk. But as we all moved around, and if she had had children, my role as a grandparent would have been limited largely to waving at a screen, and I'm not sure I would have enjoyed that.
Thank you, Ken. I don't have grandchildren either. It's a very special relationship between grandparents and their children's children, and an interesting one to observe. Margaret King now has delved into her family tree and found some fascinating stories. Here's Margaret.
Grandparents. We all have four grandparents. I only actually knew one of mine, the maternal grandmother, the others being long dead. My maternal and paternal sides were very different in lifestyles and attitudes, but I've always found my father's side the more interesting and intriguing. In the past, very large families were the order of the day, my father being the youngest of nine, and his father being the fourth of 10 sons. Pity the poor mother. Family records show that both my paternal grandfather and great-grandfather had run-ins with the law, drunken arguments and fights, mostly outside the local pub, which resulted in fines and court appearances. So, say no more. Thus, when writing upon this subject, I am taking some liberties. This account is almost word for word to one I have recently given to the Glemsford Local History Society. The village archives possess a splendid cup donated in 1936 by a Mrs. Sarah Pearman to the Glemsford Flower Show to commemorate her remarkable grandmother, Susan Pearman, who had died some 30 years before. I am travelling back in time to 1817, when both Susan Pearman and her husband William were born in Glemsford. They were my great-great-grandparents, and I want to tell you their story. During her long life, Susan worked as a silk and velvet weaver. She was a mother and a housewife, a regular attendee at the Providence Chapel, and later she became the local midwife, attending, believe it or not, over 3,000 births. She married William Pearman in 1837 and went on to have six children, one of whom was illegitimate. More about that later. The first two children, Arthur and Anna Maria, she became my great-grandmother, were shown on the 1841 census, although their father William is mysteriously absent. Again, on the 1851 census, Susan is there, plus another daughter, but no mention of William. Again, mysteriously absent. Why? Back to the records. William was indeed quite a colourful character. He worked as a labourer. He had received two minor convictions for theft, but in 1841 he fell into bad company, was arrested and charged with two counts of receiving stolen goods. This, in fact, was several sets of pigs. He was committed to Bury St Edmunds Jail and then sentenced to 7 years transportation on each charge, which made a total of 14 years. In April 1841, William was removed to the prison hulk Warrior prior to embarking upon his trip to Van Diemen's Land, known now as Tasmania. He was 23 years old, 5 feet 5 inches tall, with black hair and blue eyes. He can read, but not write. I have researched the 17th, 18th century prison hulks, and in my first account, wrote a fair amount upon them. Suffice to say here that they reflect a less than proud corner of Britain's impressive maritime history, being ripe with deaths, disease, and despair. However, great-great-granddad William was lucky. He survived the journey, and 6 months later arrived in Hobart, where he was placed on probation and set to work building a new road. He seems to have behaved himself, as he was later hired out to work for Tasmanian farmers and businessmen and was well treated. In fact, he and other cooperative convicts became part of the local community. By 1852, he had received a conditional pardon and moved on to Melbourne, where he worked in the goldfields. By the next year, he was back in England as quite a wealthy man, and upon returning to Glemsford, he purchased land and a shop. When he learnt of Ellen, wife Susan's illegitimate daughter, born during his absence, he apparently was heard to say, "Well, you broke a cup, I broke a saucer, we'll call it quits." He fathered three more children, and the 1871 census show him working as a blacksmith while Susan helped in the butcher's shop. William lived to be 79 years of age, Susan 86. They are both buried in the same grave in the east end of Glemsford Churchyard, where their gravestone is easily seen and identified. And when I consult the subsequent family tree, it is quite obvious that William and Susan eventually produced a dynasty to rival that of King Edward III. Back to the Pearman Flower Show Cup. A local historian summed up the story by saying, "This cup is a continuous reminder of man's inhumanity to man. Those who survived transportation had a very tough time. Also, it was very rare for a transportee to return to England. So it does appear that luck was on the side of my great-great-grandfather, William Pearman.
Thank you, Margaret, for sharing your forebears' history, warts and all. It's a really fascinating one. And now we have Richard Fawcett, who always has a story to tell. Well, he did suggest the topic.
I knew all four grandparents, though the men only vaguely, as they died during my childhood. My father's mother, to me, Grandma, left Britain to live in the States, where my father's sister Amy had married a GI shortly after the 39-45 war. My mother's mother, to me, Nana, was an almost permanent fixture in my life until my 20s. Of her generation, I knew my Nana's sisters, Ada and Olive, closely, as I did her brothers John and Jerry. Almora died in childhood of diphtheria, and John almost did not survive the 1418 Great War, but did eventually recover from extensive surgery. My mother had a childhood memory of John being brought home late at night in a hospital train with other wounded and in effect simply left in a quiet corner of Carlisle Station where only a few might see. Both grandfathers served in two world wars, on my father's side in the Royal Navy, then re-enlisting in the reserve in 1939, and on my mother's side in the merchant service. Because of her father's time on the Atlantic convoys, my mother told me, she and her sisters were among the few enjoying the rare privileges of bananas and nylon stockings my grandfather brought home from the States. My grandmother, Nana, played her part in that war, billeting Canadian airmen. I recall her continuing correspondences well into the post-war period. Her sister Ada, my great-aunt, was in uniform at the end of the 1418 conflict, as we know from photographs, and was present at Ypres in 1927 at the unveiling of the Menin-Gate Memorial. I have no further details, though I know she served many years later as village postmistress in Bowness and Solway. She did not marry, remaining committed, like so many women of her generation, to a sweetheart who did not survive the Western Front. It is maybe relevant to note that as a village postmistress who had served her country, had she lived in a later time, she might not have been spared the Post Office Horizon scandal. At least two footnotes to the foregoing are called for. First, and I am not certain that this is a genuine memory and not simply something I have personalised as real experience, I have at least the impression that I knew my great-grandmother on my mother's side. I have a very concrete memory that she was known to the family as Yai Yai. Not the foggiest how to spell that. And second, I trust I am not giving the impression of a family living in total harmony with each other. Quite the opposite. I remember on all sides constant fallings out and protracted not speaking marathons. It was at times, in fact, utterly impossible to know who was and was not in favour with whom. Very much like real life.
Thank you, Richard. Sitting opposite him, I could see that he was really enjoying recalling stories about his grandparents, bananas and nylons. Lucky girls indeed. Families are just families, and there's nothing we can do about that, is there? Next, we have Julie Thompson, whose first thought on hearing the topic was a surprising one, but with a very sweet ending.
Have a guess what sprang into my mind when the topic of grandparents was suggested. I'll tell you what, that extremely annoying record from St Winifred School Choir, "There's No One Quite Like Grandma." It was the first thing I thought of, as I'd recently discovered our copy in my parents' possessions when I was carrying out that unenviable task of downsizing my dad's stuff now that he's moved into care. Released in November 1980, that single must go down as one of the all-time worst songs ever. I can't believe it was the Christmas number one that year, even keeping the Yuletide classic Stop the Cavalry by Jonah Louie off the top spot. Before I resigned the vintage vinyl to the charity shop pile, I had a quick look online to make sure it wasn't a valuable 45 RPM single of 45 years of age. Nope, 313 copies available for as little as 1p on my favourite record collector's site. It did, however, make me think about my grandmas. My thoughts went straight back to the time spent with them in New Barnet and Finchley, celebrating special occasions or visiting during the school holidays. Both of them were born in the 1920s, and I now have an understanding of what their lives might have been like. Seamstresses working from home, becoming housewives and mothers too. My Grandma Mayhew lost two of her five children, and Grandma Knight didn't have the opportunity for IVF, so there was only one way for her to have a child. Oh, how different are the lives of women these days. We've a lot to be thankful for, and I'm full of gratitude to those who came before us and paved the way. Granddads. Now, did they have an awful record release, especially for them? Well, it turns out they did indeed, and it was released 9 years earlier than the Grandma Atrocity. Granddad came out in 1971. So did I, incidentally. And it was sung by Clive Dunn. Remember him as Lance Corporal Jones in Dad's Army? I found a video of it, and he's sitting in a rocking chair, wearing a flat cap, surrounded by teenage girls, lovingly looking up at him as he laments. "I've been sitting here all day, thinking, same old thing 10 years away, thinking, now my days are gone, memories linger on, thoughts of when I was a boy." No, I can't sing any more of that truly awful song. I would go as far as to say it's worse than the other one. So back to the sorting out. In a box of newspaper wrap breakables, I found a small pink glass bowl with a glass stick with bulbous ends on it. I instantly remembered this being on the mantelpiece at Grandma Knight's house in New Barnet. Isn't it odd? I hadn't given this object a thought over the last 40 years, but now it was in my hand, the memories were flooding back, and tears were making their way to my eyes. Isn't it fascinating how objects can do this? Take us back to a moment in time and invoke such strong reactions. Take the fragrance of a flower or something cooking in the oven, and there we are, transported back in time. Oh, to be sat again on Grandma's lap with the lily of the valley filling my nostrils. Back to that pink glass bowl. I found one the same for sale online. They described it as a vintage pink glass pinched trinket dish, mid-century. They wanted £44.37 for it. An odd number, I thought, in more ways than one. but it didn't have the weird glass stick with the bulbous ends. If it did, I reckon it'd be worth thousands. And if it was, I'd be shouting from the rooftops, "Grandma, we love you! Grandma, we do!"
Sorry.
Thank you, Julie. I remember both records too, though I'm so glad we got to hear about your grandparents as well. And now I have the quiz answers for you. Number one, in cricket, a lower order batsman sent in to protect a key player late in the day is called a night watchman. Number two, a 50 pence piece has seven sides. Number three, the tiger who really wants to kill Mowgli in the Jungle Book is called Shere Khan. Number four, when entering US Customs, Oscar Wilde said, "I have nothing to declare but my genius." Number five, one for the grandparents. Bing Crosby's partner in The Road to Morocco and other road films was, of course, Bob Hope. Number six, it was the author J.M. Barrie in Peter Pan who first invented the name Wendy, which apparently came about when a young person known to him called him her Wendy Wendy. I guess you had to be there. Number seven, Scotland's national flower is the thistle. Number eight, there are no locks on the Suez Canal, so maybe a little bit of a trick question. Number nine, the name of the ancient Celtic fire festival, which is the forerunner of our current day May Day celebrations, was called Beltane, and it's still celebrated by some people. Number 10, you should ne'er cast a clout until May is out. A clout is a cloth, but is May the month or the flower? Hawthorn blossom. I think the jury's out on that one. But those are the answers to the questions. And now, last but not least, here's Toby Jacobs' piece about his grandparents, kindly read by Ken Watkins.
Slippery when wet. For those listeners who were hoping that one of my ancestors was a member of the 80s poodle-permed soft rock outfit Bon Jovi, I hate to disappoint you. However, a tale of piscatorial delights may well prove to be just as enlightening. As I stare down at the black and white photo before me, I see an array of men of assorted stature and dress. There's a London bobby to the rear, two porters complete with bobbin hats to the fore, and a man in a shirt and tie carrying a large halibut. This, dear listeners, is my paternal grandad, Solomon Solly Jacobs. It's 1949, and the location is Old Billingsgate Wharf on the banks of the River Thames. Just sneaking into the background is the London Bridge that was bought by the USA and now stands at Lake Havasu. I've often wondered how this picture came to be taken. Was it because there was an arcane bylaw prohibiting the carrying of halibut on a Thursday, hence the market policeman? Perhaps it was the comedy hats worn by the porters that attracted the attention of the photographer. Incidentally, these were flat to balance crates of fish on and high-rimmed to contain any fish slime. By the time of this photo, Billingsgate Fish Market in London was one of the biggest in the world, and the company, Sydney Jacobs & Sons, was one of the most respected of the various wholesalers based there. Solly had taken charge of the business when his father Sydney had retired. From the time of his birth in Poplar in 1910, it was inevitable that one day he would do so. By all accounts, my great-grandfather was an inveterate gambler, and the legend goes that Solly took over just in time, saving the business from certain bankruptcy. He was an astute businessman, branching out into fish and chip shops, newsagents and grocers, One of his premises on Brixton Hill was reputed to be the first of its kind in London to sell frozen convenience food, ably promoted by his loving wife and confidant. Q. Ethel Dorcas Jacobs, my nan. Born in Nunhead in 1915, she was a larger-than-life character, both in stature and personality. She was a foil to Solly's somewhat dour demeanour. They were often referred to as the Prince and the Showgirl. Peggy, as she was known, was rightly proud of Solly's growing empire, and was known for her elaborate soirees in their house in Clapham Park. My mum always said that she put on a fantastic spread. There was more than a little of the Hattie Jakes about her. However, even though they fought like cat and dog, they idolised one another, producing a son and a daughter. When her husband died of a heart attack in 1979, that was the end of a great partnership. Peggy survived Solly by another 20 years. Meanwhile, 4,000 miles away across the Atlantic, an important baseball game was coming to a conclusion. The Pawtucket White Sox needed to win in order to stay in their current division. The pitcher, a rather tall and imposing figure, had already pitched two strikes and only needed a third to get his opponent out and win the game. He drew back his whole body, swiveled onto his left foot, and let that ball go with sheer determination. As the batsman executed his attempt at contact, it was already too late. Strike three, and he was out. The pitcher was surrounded by his teammates and held aloft. The hero of that day was my maternal grandpa, Spencer Round. Looking at the only photograph I have of the team, they look more like a penal colony than a baseball team, a regular rogues gallery. They were just a local semi-professional outfit, with ambitions rather more than the sum of their parts. My grandpa struggled on and eventually was offered a contract with the St. Louis Cardinals, no less. Legend has it that the night before he was due to sign, he cut his hand quite badly and had to withdraw, never to play again. Fate can really throw a curveball sometimes, just like one of his pitches. So what does any self-respecting young man do when they're at a crossroads in their life? They join the Navy, of course. Spencer took himself off to Norfolk, Virginia, and enrolled as an able seaman. Over time, he worked his way through the ranks, becoming a specialist aerial photographer. He saw action in Korea and even spent some time in Okinawa. It was while on shore leave, back in Rhode Island, that he spotted a local farm girl with almond eyes and a dark complexion. Elizabeth Suarez, my grandma, was the daughter of Portuguese immigrants. You could say that she looked rather exotic. Spencer certainly thought so. They courted for some time and still eventually tying the knot. As I look at a photograph taken on their wedding day, I see my grandpa looking very handsome in his Navy uniform and Elizabeth looking beautiful in a handmade dress and corsage. They had a good life together, having four girls. When both sets of my grandparents sent their progeny out into the world, as fate would have it, two continents were set to collide. In North Audley Street, West 1, to be precise. When Joyce and Round left Greenville, Rhode Island, to seek out the Beatles in the UK, little did she know what awaited her. Bearing an uncanny resemblance to Paul McCartney, John Sidney Jacobs was waiting in the queue for coffee, and the rest, as they say, is history. Q, the author of this article, 4 years later.
Thank you very much, Toby. Of course, I did have a picture of a mental picture of you as some soft rock hipster, but you've disabused us of that. But what a fascinating grandparentage you have. And thank you very much for telling us about it. And also, I should say that Toby did send us photographs of his grandparents, and they're just as described. They're beautiful photographs of a wedding and work and play, and just fascinating to see. And very kindly, thank you very much to Ken for reading on Toby's behalf. And now that's the end of our recording today. I think it's been a very interesting one in lots of ways. Thank you very much for being with us and for listening. Thank you to our not just technician, but contributor, Trevor Green, for one night only. And we look forward to entertaining you next time. Bye.